In Afghanistan, ethnic minorities have reason to worry about a growing backlash from an emboldened Taliban.
Now the Taliban are more arrogant, they are more powerful, they claim that they have defeated the strongest military alliance of the world.
Hazaras, who are Shia Muslims, say the Taliban are forcing them from their homes. Also today, climate change is impacting French vineyards. Winemakers say it's important to honor their traditional work.
At the same time, we also need to be ready for what's next.
And an artist who is hard of hearing finds an ideal spot to showcase her work, an old German church with bad acoustics.
Because it sort of renders my audience hard of hearing, which is a connecting point for me.
I'm Marco Werman. Plus, we tackle one of humanity's biggest mysteries, just how long can we live? Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thank you for joining us. We start today in Afghanistan, where residents of Dikundi province in the central part of the country say that Taliban fighters are forcing them out of their homes. The victims are from the country's Hazara ethnic group. They're mostly Shia Muslims who speak the Persian language and have lived in that part of Afghanistan for centuries. Hazaras have faced persecution and violence going back many years. But as The World's Shirin Jafari reports, now the Taliban are evicting them and taking their land.
On a recent afternoon, residents of Dikundi province were on the move. This is from a cell phone video shared with me. It shows kids herding a couple of goats out of a village. Behind them, donkeys carry piles of blankets, clothes, pots and pans, whatever the villagers manage to take with them in a rush. This is the fate of hundreds of families. They've been forced out of their homes over the past few weeks. Residents of Dikundi province tell me the Taliban ordered them to leave, sometimes giving them only 3 or 4 days to pack up and go. Then, after they're gone, they say the Taliban set fire to their homes or blow them up. In this video, taken from a hilltop, smoke is rising from one family's home. And a few minutes later, a blast rips through the mud structure, destroying it completely. 42-year-old Haji Muhammadi is one of those driven out of his home, which was then set ablaze. He fled Dikundi with his family and is now taking refuge in the capital, Kabul. Since early September, Muhammadi tells me the Taliban have been telling people that this is their land. And when people complained, he says they were arrested. The mistreatment of Hazara people in Afghanistan is nothing new. The Taliban and Islamic State have carried out brutal attacks against them for years. But since the Taliban takeover last month, forced evictions are becoming more common.
11 نفر از اینا نظامی بودن که اونا تسلیم شده بودن به طالبان.
When the Taliban took over our province, Muhammadi says, they executed Afghan army soldiers even after they surrendered. He says the Taliban also killed civilians, including women and children. Videos of these executions have been shared online. The Taliban says it's giving amnesty to anyone who worked in the previous government. But accounts like those of Muhammadi and others in Afghanistan tell a different story. A Taliban spokesman did not respond to my request for comment. Salim Javed is a human rights advocate based in Sweden and says the situation in Dikundi province is dire.
It's estimated that about 1,500 to 1,600 families have been forced to leave their villages.
The Taliban is claiming they have ownership over the land in this area. But the people who are being driven out of their homes, who are mainly farmers, say they have lived there for hundreds of years.
They have also ordered the people not to take their wheat, almond, or other agricultural products with themselves, only some very basic necessaries.
The displaced families are taking shelter anywhere they can. Some have fled to other provinces, and they're living in mosques or abandoned buildings. In another video shared with me from Dikundi, an older man addresses the Taliban and asks why they won't show mercy. I'm 65 years old, he says, and I have lived on this land all my life. Now you're telling me to leave? Rehane Azad is a former member of Afghanistan's parliament. She represented Dikundi province until last month. She got death threats from the Taliban after the government fell and had to leave the country. Over a WhatsApp call from Albania, where she's based now, she tells me she's been getting frantic messages from people back home. She says they're asking for help in text messages, over Facebook, and anywhere else they can. But what can I do for them, she says. I have no power now. The Taliban took everything from us, Azad says. Now they're taking away our land and homes. As the winter months get closer and much of the world's attention on Afghanistan fades away, Rehane Azad says she worries about the fate of displaced Hazaras and so many others in her country. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
The value of Bitcoin, the digital currency, has skyrocketed. What's also shot up exponentially is the amount of energy required to generate the cryptocurrency. Mining Bitcoin, that's the term, requires massive amounts of computing power to calculate complex mathematics to make the currency work. And that burns up an incredible amount of electricity. China had been the epicenter of this until a recent ban that sent many Bitcoin miners scrambling to other countries. One of those places is Laos in Southeast Asia. To tell us what's going on there, the world's Patrick Nguyen is on the line. So how did Laos become a center for cryptocurrency, Patrick?
Well, Laos is this small communist country. It only has 8 million people. That's a smaller population than New York City. It's landlocked. It's mountainous. Most people are farmers. It does not have a sizable economy. But one thing Laos does have, Marco, is these powerful rivers. And there are dozens of hydropower dams built on those rivers, generating tons of electricity, and it's way more than the population can even use. So at the moment, most of that electricity gets exported to richer neighbors like China or Thailand, and the idea with cryptocurrency is, why not invite cryptocurrency miners to come and use that electricity to create more Bitcoin and Ethereum and all these other cryptocurrencies out there?
Why did China think cryptocurrency was harmful, and why would Laos welcome this sort of investment if China is leery of it?
China has many reasons why it might be leery of cryptocurrency, but one of its stated reasons is all of the CO2 that gets burned. So when cryptocurrency mining isn't, you know, using a pickaxe and a hard hat, it's using these computer processors that process these really complicated math problems, and they heat up and use a ton of energy. China was using as much energy as the country of Finland does in a year just on cryptocurrency mining. So when it comes to Laos right now, its economy is in rough shape. It has zero tourists coming in because of COVID-19. It's in massive debt. It needs some sort of influx of cash. And so now the government is starting to allow companies that are already affiliated and on good terms with the government to mine Bitcoin so it can tax their profits. And it looks like, or at least it's highly possible, that in the near future, they'll open up and let more cryptocurrency miners with all of their energy-hungry computer processors come in and set up shop. The government is still hashing out its policy. I think one thing to keep in mind, Marco, is Laos has become, I'm sorry to say, sort of a dumping ground for activity that gets banned in China. So after China cracked down on casinos, casinos tailoring to Chinese customers popped up in Laos. China cracks down on illegal wildlife trading, that increases in Laos. So I'm not saying cryptocurrency is inherently sinister like wildlife trading, but it does follow a pattern.
I understand that, and the rough economy in Laos is attracting this perhaps, but the world is laser focused on reducing carbon emissions right now. Another big climate conference is coming up in a few weeks. Isn't that also a factor for Laos?
Yes. Well, there may be some good news here. If you're just worried about the carbon emissions, it's probably better to have the Bitcoin generated in Laos than China, because in China, a lot of that energy was coming from coal. And in Laos, if it becomes a crypto mining hotspot, that energy will be produced by hydropower from these dams. I've been to see these big hydropower dams in Laos before. They're absolutely massive. They're not great for the local environment, honestly. They do devastate wildlife. They kill fish. They affect the flow of the river. It's not perfect. It's not pretty. But they don't generate more CO2. So that's good. As for how the people of Laos, what they will get out of this, probably not much. I mean, rice farmers don't care much about Bitcoin, but this is really nothing new. It's been pretty well established in Laos that natural resources get harnessed to help out a wealthy subset of foreigners and government officials, and local people don't usually get much in return.
The world's Patrick Nguyen, our correspondent in Southeast Asia. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
Deadlines come and go, but the one missed today is a big one, vaccinating 10% of every country's population. In May, the World Health Assembly set that as a goal to meet by today, but in 59 nations, that has not happened. One big reason, lack of access to vaccines, but vaccine hesitancy is also a serious problem, which we're going to focus on now. A new global survey looks at vaccine hesitancy in 23 countries. Dr. Scott Ratson is one of the authors. He's a health communication expert at the CUNY School of Public Health. Dr. Ratson, when we talk vaccine hesitancy, how much of the world's population is actually keen to get the COVID vaccine?
Last year, we ran a 19-country survey, and about 72% of the world's population was ready to get vaccinated with the COVID vaccine if it would be available. It was a hypothetical question. Now that a vaccine is available, we asked the public in 23 countries, would they be willing to take a vaccine? And it is up slightly. About 3 out of 4 people around the world are willing to take the vaccine. And it even is as high as 90% of those in Brazil. And we're asking the question generally, so not on what type of vaccine, but a vaccine for COVID.
So give us a few examples of countries where vaccine hesitancy is going up and where it's also going down.
It's been very low in certain countries, such as France. We would expect it to be low. And we found that last year, about 59% of the people were willing to take the vaccine. This year, 64% were willing to take it in June. But even better is that with the right policies in place, as well as campaigns, we have seen France even going higher than what our surveys have mentioned. So the message here is that vaccine hesitancy, it can be overcome and it can move. But frankly, we may be hitting the wall at 3/4 of the world's population willing to take the vaccine.
Interesting. I mean, we have seen angry protests in France to mandates on masks and employer vaccine mandates. For the people in the 23 countries who are no longer hesitant, who or what convinced them?
One of the number one reasons where people are getting vaccinated is, frankly, they believe that COVID can threaten them. So it's the personal risk, and they know of someone who's sick or they've known of someone who has died. I think also now we've had enough of millions or hundreds of millions of people who've had the vaccine that they no longer are worried about the safety profile that they might have. And the perceived risk of getting the disease is much more than the perception of getting anything from the vaccine that would be anything but protection.
You're in New York, where employer vaccine mandates have been key in moving the needle for the hesitant ones. Are employer mandates being accepted in most of the world?
Just to go back to France, as soon as they mentioned they were going to have a COVID health pass that you needed to go to restaurants, cafes, bars, within a week, they had another uptick of 2.2 million. You know, the U.S. has actually been along the lower end. China is the highest at 94%, Peru 81%, South Korea, India, all of these are well over 3/4 of the people accepting of a mandate that would be issued by the employer, and even higher if it's issued by the government in those same countries. And Russia and Poland, for whatever reasons, it could go back again to the distrust in government that they've had historically, are the lowest of accepting governmental mandates below 40%.
In Russia, even some doctors seem mistrustful of Sputnik, the local vaccine there, because of the lack of transparency and data. Are attitudes changing at all in Russia?
31% would accept a mandate if it came from an employer. About a third, 33.6%, would accept it if it came from their government. Part of the reason is the rushed nature of the Sputnik V vaccine, the way they also have been communicating about the reality of the threat of COVID. And it's not just Russia, it's some of the other governments. When you have politicians that are not following the science or what looks like political expediency, people would be less apt to follow their policies.
Dr. Scott Ratson, one of the authors of a new survey of global vaccine hesitancy, the results of which are still preliminary, we should say. Ratson is a health communication expert at the CUNY School of Public Health. Thank you very much. Good to speak with you.
Thank you very much, Marco.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The acoustics of a new art show at the Kunsthalle Osnabrück Art Museum in northwest Germany are perplexing, and that is on purpose. American artist and filmmaker Alison O'Daniel was drawn to the venue. It's housed in a former church first built in the late 1200s. The appeal for her? She likes to work in spaces with bad acoustics. O'Daniel says it helps show others how she hears the world. From Osnabrück, reporter Stephanie Wolf has our story.
When Alison O'Daniel was in her mid-20s, she wrote a list to put to words how she experiences sound.
Like simultaneous combination of confusion, frustration, a psychedelic kind of experience, a sensitivity.
She's had hearing aids since she was 3. Her hearing aids now, digital ones, sometimes give her a heightened sense of sound, like a car engine hum becomes ear-splitting. This hypersensitivity can be just as frustrating as missing information when she can't hear. But O'Daniel also finds the mix of the two fascinating, and she's spent most of her art career focused on recreating it.
There is something really rich for me particularly to work with bad acoustics because it sort of renders my audience hard of hearing, which is a connecting point for me.
She might have found her most ideal setting in the Kunsthalle Osnabrück. Her solo show, I Felt People Dancing, opened here in June. It's staged in the part of this old Gothic-style church where congregants gathered to worship centuries ago. The structures that once provided its acoustic glory, like the pulpit and choir loft, are gone. What remains is a cavernous room with high curved ceilings and stone columns. The sound is unpredictable, bizarre even, and changes as you move around. O'Daniel says it's similar to how she hears.
You could hear really well, and then all of a sudden you wouldn't be able to hear, and then things bounce off the walls in strange ways.
What you're hearing right now is coming from several large subwoofers spread throughout the room, positioned in ways that might make a sound engineer cringe, like facing a wall from a few feet away. The speakers are playing sound from 5 flat-screen TVs stationed where the pews used to be. The TVs feature scenes from a film O'Daniel made about a deaf woman who receives a drum kit.
And there's sound delays, and then the sound from all 5 videos kind of is like crashing in on one another. Some of the speakers get pushed to a max.
We came across Alison's work and we thought, it's perfect.
That's Kunsthalle Osnabrück co-director Anna Jila. Every year, Jila and her colleagues choose an annual theme. This year's is accessibility.
And in German, it's actually much more beautiful. It's Barrierefreiheit, which means like barrier and freedom. And then the question is like, whose freedom are we actually talking about? So whose freedom is the norm?
They come at this theme from a variety of perspectives, looking at sexism, racism, classism, ableism, anything that might be used to exclude someone. Jila says this season's work is already informing how they'll curate future shows.
I naively believe that art can give another perspective on community and believe it would be beautiful if many people could experience it. And it's not that people don't want to or are not interested. It's because they actually haven't been invited.
2 residents from the town of Osnabrück, Germany, are in fact represented in Alison O'Daniel's show. Because of COVID, she wasn't able to visit the art center before designing the installation. So the Kunsthalle found 2 volunteers who are deaf or hard of hearing to be O'Daniel's, quote, surrogate ears. They documented what the space felt and sounded like through written notes and symbols, like squiggly lines and arrows. These notations were then blown up and printed on a large carpet that blankets part of the space.
And one of them had this one note that said, I felt people dancing. And that's where the title of the show came from.
She says she's not sure what made the volunteer write that down, and she doesn't need to know.
Because there is this thing about my hearing where I'm constantly wrestling with this missing information. And so I didn't feel like I needed to know what every symbol meant.
She says she found that beautiful. For The World, I'm Stephanie Wolf in Osnabrück, Germany.
Most people try to break Guinness World Records while they're still alive, but a family in the East African nation of Eritrea is trying to get Guinness to recognize their grandfather as the oldest man to have ever lived. Natabe Tinsiu died this week. He was 127 years old, according to his family. As we and Guinness await confirmation, the story got us thinking, just how long can humans live? And is there a trick to longevity? To answer these age-old mysteries, we're turning to Dr. James Kirkland. He directs the Robert and Arlene Kogod Center on Aging at the Mayo Clinic and joins us from Rochester, Minnesota. Dr. Kirkland, the family in Eritrea claims their relative lived to 127 and they have documentation to prove it. Does that strike you as plausible, first of all, and is that the outer limit for a human lifespan?
It may be plausible. Up to now, the longest-lived person was woman in France who was just short of that same age. So it might well be plausible, but we'll have to see the documentation.
Mm. And 127, can humans live beyond that?
Who knows at this point? The real focus of the field, rather than looking at maximum lifespan, is trying to look at and improve what we call health span, the period during life when people are living free, independent, and without multiple diseases and chronic pain. The notion, I think, across the aging field is to focus on adding life to years rather than years to life.
So what are the factors that determine how people will manage to live a long life?
There are increasingly discoveries about what we call the pillars of aging, the fundamental processes that begin from conception on, from the beginning of life on, that result ultimately in an increase in disease predisposition and in changes that occur with aging in older individuals.
Life can be difficult when you live past 100. I can't imagine being in my 120s, but with all the advances in science, will we start to see people not just living longer, but living better as we get into, I don't know, what do we call this, extreme old age?
So there are ways now that we can target some of these fundamental pillars of aging. And in experimental animals, at least, there's a lot of promise. And clinical trials have started for conditions that are serious, but where we know that fundamental aging processes from experimental animal studies appear to make a contribution. And these include things like Alzheimer's disease, consequences of chemotherapy or radiation, what happens in obesity and diabetes, even coronavirus. There are three trials underway now of these kinds of agents to try to reduce morbidity and mortality from coronavirus based on targeting fundamental aging processes.
So if we're looking to live deep into old age and live well, you've mentioned a couple of things, diet, exercise, don't smoke, anything else?
Stress and psychological stress and other kinds of things can be issues. Getting regular preventive care. We know that certain kinds of cancer screening and so forth are very valuable. Immunizations along the way for disorders that target people in particular phases of life are very, very important. So all of these things together and reducing risky behaviors and so forth where that's appropriate can help.
Dr. James Kirkland is an expert on aging. He's the director of the Robert and Arlene Kogod Center on Aging at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Doctor, thank you very much.
Thanks.
We'll be right back with more in the second half of the show. You're listening to The World. For the first time, Canada is marking a new federal holiday, a day to remember Indigenous children who were sent to schools that tried to erase their culture.
It should be received and commemorated in a very solemn way.
Also, a documentary film gets banned in Kenya for dealing with gay marriage. That's all ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. A grisly scene in Ecuador today. A prison riot has left at least 116 inmates dead and some 80 injured. Local media are reporting that the riot was tied to rival Mexican drug cartels. Kim Brown is a reporter based in Ecuador and joins me now from the capital, Quito. Fill us in on the details here, Kim. This riot happened at a penitentiary in Guayaquil, a port city southwest from where you are in Quito. What led to this riot and how did it unfold?
The riot was centered in El Litoral prison in Guayaquil earlier this week. What we know so far is that 116 people have been killed within the context of the riots, as you mentioned. But as the government has also told the media last night, is that they don't have the situation totally under control yet. So those numbers might increase. What we know is that apparently the spark for the riots happened between armed groups who largely control the prison, and they were fighting over control of a particular wing of the prison. I mean, one of the problems in Ecuadorian prisons is that they're largely understaffed, and there's a deficit of about 70% deficit in guards in prisons across the country.
So what Ecuadorian officials are saying is that this was a result of a clash between two gangs, Los Lobos and Los Choneros. They both have ties to Mexican drug cartels, apparently. What can you tell us about these groups? How are they tied to Mexican drug gangs and how do they operate in prisons?
Officials have known that there are at least six gangs who largely control the prisons. In other contexts and other riots, the fighting has largely been between Los Choneros and Los Lagartos, which is another dominant group also with supposed ties to Mexican cartels. But I mean, everyone in prisons has a cell phone. It's not hard to get one. It's not hard to smuggle one in. The level of corruption within these prison systems, I mean, within the guards and the police running them, is quite high, and it's been a concern for years, and that it's not hard to smuggle things in. In the last riots in July, for example, 22 people were killed within the prison riots, and people were found with small chainsaws. And so you see, these are things that even if the police or the guards didn't directly help smuggle them in, they definitely had to close a blind eye to not find them in their cells.
So riots in Ecuador and prisons in February, July, and now. Is it these gang rivalries combined with the pressures of overcrowding during the pandemic and substandard healthcare that's leading to all this?
One of the reasons that triggered these very violent riots this year was a particular murder that happened in 2020, where the leader of the group Los Choneros, Jorge Luis Zambrano, he was killed very publicly in the city of Manta. And I don't believe that the person who killed him was ever caught or brought to trial or anything. So apparently knocking down the leader of Los Choneros, which is one of the bigger groups within Ecuador, caused a kind of fight for territory, kind of both inside and outside the prisons. But we're seeing it play out more strongly within the prisons.
I mean, given that this seems like an ongoing problem in some of Ecuador's prisons, what have human rights groups been discussing about solutions?
Human rights groups are criticizing the President Guillermo Lasso's response, calling a state of emergencies or state of exceptions, which call for the use of force against situations in prisons, because they're saying you have to respect also the rights of people who are within prisons. One of the issues here is that 40% of the current prison population in Ecuador are still people awaiting trial or sentencing, so they haven't even been found guilty of crimes yet. And so human rights groups are calling for an all-around prison reform, which includes rethinking how we classify crimes worthy of imprisonment. They're also calling for more investment in social development in the country in general, also cracking down on corruption within the prison system, which are all things that have to change, not just implementing more guards in the system and more force that the guards are able to use.
Kim Brown is a reporter based in Ecuador, speaking with us from Quito about the riot yesterday at the penitentiary in Guayaquil that left more than 116 people dead. Kim, thank you very much.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Today marks Canada's National Day for Truth and Reconciliation, honoring the lost children as well as the survivors sent to state and church-run residential schools. Those schools were set up across Canada as a colonial tool to try to erase Indigenous cultures. This is the first year the day is being recognized as a federal holiday. The World's Bianca Hillier spoke with Indigenous people across Canada to hear what the day means to them.
Wambadi Wakita is from the Sioux Valley Dakota Nation. He grew up in the 1940s, spending his early years living on the reserve and speaking the Dakota language. But at just 7 years old, he was forced into a nearby residential school.
Our culture was taken and they told us not to speak our language.
Wakita spent a total of 8 years at two different residential schools. He and other survivors say they faced a wide range of emotional and physical abuse.
It turned me off completely to education. They took away everything, and that's a pretty tough thing to go through.
Wakita was one of an estimated 150,000 children to attend these schools, according to the Canadian government. Thousands of students are known to have died, though the actual toll may never be known because records were destroyed over the years. The deaths made international headlines earlier this year when hundreds of unmarked graves were found on former school grounds.
Remains of more than 200 children have been located.
As many as 751 unmarked graves were discovered on Thursday.
And they say that to their knowledge, these deaths were undocumented up until this point.
The country's National Truth and Reconciliation Commission calls this cultural genocide and says it took place from 1883 to 1996. Today, Indigenous communities across the country want people to know this is recent history.
It should be received and commemorated in a very solemn way.
Michelle Good is the author of a book called Five Little Indians, which chronicles the journey of five residential school survivors. Her own family attended the schools, and she hopes non-Indigenous people will use today to listen and learn.
I hope it gives them time to consider taking responsibility for their own education, for memorializing the children that never made it home, and the children that made it home so broken that they couldn't fit into their homes and communities anymore.
The oppression of Indigenous people didn't end when the schools closed their doors. Brenda Gunn, academic and research director at the National Center for Truth and Reconciliation, says many Canadian systems continue to negatively impact Indigenous communities.
The justice system, the education system, the healthcare system, the child welfare system, the loss of language and culture, you know, those are all issues that continue to exist, right? So this really isn't a history. There's a history that underlies it that people need to understand, but there are ongoing impacts.
Recognizing these impacts through a federal holiday was one of the 94 calls to action by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission back in 2015. Not all provinces are backing the effort on a local level, but that isn't stopping communities from marking the occasion. Talks and memorial walks are happening across the country. Resources are being distributed about how to talk to young kids about all of this. And students are learning songs from Indigenous musicians, like in this classroom in Ontario. And on the grounds of one former residential school, members of the Tekumloop Shwatmik First Nation will play an honor song for the lives lost. These are the languages and cultures the residential schools tried to erase. It's the reality of colonialism that author Michelle Good says is relevant to those far outside Canadian borders.
It affects everybody. Indigenous people across the entire world have experienced these kinds of tools of colonialism that are used, and particularly those that are directed at children.
Good says she believes it's a moral responsibility for people to know and understand this living history so that it won't happen again. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
In Kenya, the government has banned a documentary that explores the struggles of a young gay Kenyan man. Kenya's film board said the documentary blatantly violates the country's laws that criminalize homosexuality and same-sex marriage, and that the storyline was, quote, a clear and deliberate attempt to promote same-sex marriage as an acceptable way of life, end quote. The documentary, I Am Samuel, took 5 years to put together and was made by Kenyan Peter Marimi, who joins us now from London. Peter, what is the basic storyline of your documentary?
It's about love, and it's basically a story of a young man, a young Kenyan man who grew up in the countryside, went to the city, fell in love, but also it's a story about the parents who really struggle to deal with their son's sexuality, and it's eventually also a love story between the father and son and how eventually the father accepted his son for who he is. And this is very representative of very many Kenyan gay men right now.
2 years ago, the Kenyan government banned another film about an LGBTQ couple. It was called Rafiki, a drama about two women. Why did you think it would be any different for your movie?
I was a bit optimistic because this is a documentary. Unlike Rafiki, was a script which turned into a film. And then the government was like, yeah, this is an agenda because the director had a storyline that they're pushing. But I was telling a story about real people. This is real life. Nothing is scripted. And I'm a journalist. So I thought censoring journalism, even if you don't like the message, but you cannot censor journalism. So I thought that although the classification board is his decisions before have been homophobic, but I thought this being journalistic would pass the test and Kenyans would be able to see it.
Are you appealing the ban?
The law actually should be changed. The law is a really bad law because it gives so much power to the classification board. Like if they think Donald Duck is inappropriate for Kenyans, they can restrict it and they have the power to do that. But we are going to appeal, but also in the court of public opinion, because two things need to change in Kenya. Definitely the law needs to change, but also the public needs to have very constructive dialogue about LGBTQ plus rights, but also about freedom of expression and censorship. So we're going to have this debate and let's see what progress we make.
In this digital age we're living in, Peter, how effective can Kenya's ban be? I mean, won't Kenyans be able to see your movie online anyway?
The world is changing so fast. And obviously, the law is not keeping up with how fast the world is changing. The thing is, because I'm Kenyan, most of the production company is Kenyan, the crew, the producer is Kenyan, like so many people who worked in this film are Kenyan. So the truth is, if we could just put it online, sell it to a company online and they stream it in Kenya, it could be fine, but we could have legal responsibility and we're Kenyans. Mm. And we're intending to appeal it and we're intending to fight, but we'll fight within this law that would jeopardize us and we would end up in jail. Because the penalty is stiff. It's 5 years in jail.
Wow.
So it's not a joke. It's really stiff.
What about the rest of Africa? Are you aiming for distribution across the continent?
This is the beauty, actually, of this digital age. We are going to release this film for free across Africa. Like every country in Africa from the 13th of next month can watch the film.
Are you concerned, though, that some countries will try to shut down access to the streaming service that I Am Samuel is available on?
That is possible, but what we're willing to do is deal with it on a case-by-case basis. But we have an advantage. We're not legally, there's no jurisdiction over us because we're Kenyans. So if any country, for example, Zimbabwe complains, it's much more harder and difficult for them to pull it down.
Tell me a bit more about Samuel, the subject of the documentary. What's his life like these days? Is he in any danger, given that he's Kenyan?
So he's not in Kenya anymore. He's doing well. He's starting a new chapter in his life at the moment.
Did Samuel leave Kenya because of concern over the reaction he could get from the film?
Yeah, like during the making of this film, it became very clear that when we release this film, it will not be safe for him legally to be in Kenya.
Peter, I'm curious, did you set out to make a political film almost to test the Kenyan government?
It's the opposite. Because this film, I really tried to keep away from the politics because I knew how flammable that issue is. Talking about marriage, talking about LGBTQ plus rights. So I made a very personal story. It's a love story. It's a very personal story about someone. You can see he struggles. He works in a construction site and he has to deal with the expectations of parents like we all do. So this is a very personal story and it's ended up being political, but my intention was completely the opposite.
Peter Marima is a Kenyan filmmaker and journalist. His latest documentary, I Am Samuel, has been banned by the Kenyan government. Peter, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
One silver lining to living through a year and a half plus long pandemic, it's forced a lot of us to reexamine our priorities, even how we express our faith. For example, for centuries in Muslim-majority Turkey, many people have prayed five times a day, as is the practice in Islam. But during the pandemic, the five times daily call to prayer has taken on a new significance. From Istanbul, Duri Buscarin has our next story.
In a big Muslim-majority city like this one, the call to prayer comes from loudspeakers at multiple mosques, one after the other. It's almost like a chorus. But in one of Istanbul's smaller neighborhood mosques, you'll hear just a single voice delivering the call to prayer. It's 31-year-old Abdullah Aydin.
Allah!
He's from Diyarbakir, a predominantly Kurdish city in the southeastern part of Turkey. He's served as a muezzin here, the person who sings the call, for the past 2 years. Through a translator, Aydin says that when he sings the call to prayer, there's a lot on his mind.
Of course, like you're thinking about the tones and etc., but you also need to be really sincere about it, because every word has like really deep meanings.
At the height of the COVID pandemic, Aydin spent his days distributing donations to the elderly and trying to convince some of the most devout members of the community that they should not come to the mosque, that it was okay to pray at home. He's somewhat new to the job, so he'd often be asked to fill in for other muezzins when they got sick. On those days, even though people couldn't always go out into the streets, Aydin's voice could.
You can't help but get emotional.
The call to prayer is known as the azan in Turkish, or the adhan in Arabic. There are different stylistic ways to sing it, and Aydin does them carefully. A softer, melodic one for the dawn prayer, a jovial call for lunchtime, which sounds like it's in a major key, and another, separate one, called the salah. It's used to announce a death in the neighborhood and ask for the forgiveness of the departed soul.
There was a period that I was making salah every single day, you know, in different mosques, because there was someone passing away every single day.
More than 63,000 people have died of COVID in Turkey, according to official counts. It's hard to ignore a pandemic when a loudspeaker announces the name of every victim who lived near you. But Abdullah Aydin is philosophical about it. He sees this call as an echo of the prayer that Muslim parents whisper into the ear of a newborn baby.
So it's like there's two points, like the beginning of life and the end of life. The ritual like is stemming from that.
And that's the way it's worked for hundreds of years. The first call to prayer of the day comes before dawn, when the lights from the windows of the earliest risers are just starting to go on in the apartments around you. Surely not everyone is praying at exactly this moment, but it's clear that some people are, and maybe that's why it's a comfort. As the call fades and you hear the calls from the mosques in other parts of town, you know that everyone is hearing the same thing, and probably hoping for some certainty amid these times of so much uncertainty. For The World, I'm Derry Bouscarin in Istanbul.
It's time for the annual grape harvest in France. This year, growers will be picking less than usual. The French government says the wine industry lost about a third of this year's crop because of extreme weather events related to climate change. This week on The Big Fix, how the wine industry is trying to adapt.
We have come here to let you know that change is coming, whether you like it or not.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
The only option that we have is to succeed.
What we do now and in the next few years will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
We're going to the home of Saint-Emilion and Chateau Lafite, Bordeaux, where winemakers and scientists are experimenting with new ways to make French wine more resilient to a changing climate. From Bordeaux, reporter Rebecca Rossman has that story.
Jonathan Ducour is a fourth-generation wine grower with an 1,100-acre property located just outside Bordeaux.
Sure.
He invites me on top of a grape harvesting machine.
And it collects the grapes, mostly the berries, little by little.
As we snake through the rows of vines, the machine shakes the fruit and scoops it up. In a normal year, Ducour says his family produces around 3 million bottles of wine. But this year...
For the whites, we almost finished the harvest, so we know we lost about 50%.
And he expects a 30% loss of red wine grapes. That's because of a warm early spring and a severe late frost that killed many of his grapes. Experts say those conditions were made more likely by climate change, and they were followed by heavy rains, which fueled mildew.
This little grape was attacked by a mushroom and...
It's all dried up.
Yeah.
The number of unexpected weather events have only increased for the Ducour family over the last 10 years. He says they even took out a special climate change insurance for winemakers. But they're working on a longer-term solution. He takes me to another corner of the vineyard and shows off his experimental vines.
We harvested this block last week.
Most of the vineyard has pure vines, growing only one type of grape. That's the standard in France. The six we're looking at right now have different grape varieties grafted onto each vine. These varieties were specially selected because they're more resistant to things like drought and late frost.
So this one is called Sauvignac, and it's a hybrid of Sauvignon Blanc, Riesling, and wild vines.
Okay, we're tasting the grape here. This is the hybrid. Oh, it's a good grape.
But these hybrid vines are also controversial. In France, where tradition is king, wine can only be labeled Bordeaux if it's made with any six kinds of traditional grape varieties. Ducour says he respects this tradition, but...
At the same time, we also need to be ready for what's next.
Hybrid wines have already been widely embraced in Germany and Switzerland, and some hybrid varieties have been approved for use in certain table wines in France.
So, in between the wooden posts here, there's five vines in each row.
At an experimental vineyard on the outskirts of Bordeaux, Mark Gowdy shows students some of the more than 50 grape varieties he's been studying at the Institute of Sciences for Vine and Wines. Gaudi, who moved here from California, says getting tradition-bound French winemakers on board with these experimental vines has been a bit of an uphill battle. Whereas in the U.S.,
I can plant whatever I want from wherever I want, whenever I want. It's literally the Wild West, right?
Some of the most successful varieties in the experimental vineyard come from southern European countries with a slightly warmer climate, including Spain, Portugal, and Italy. But testing new varieties isn't the only solution for wine growers, Gaudi says. Special pruning techniques are being tested to protect the vines.
For instance, right here, this is a style of pruning where you have a big bushy vine and you're potentially providing protection for the fruit from sun and heat.
Gaudi also says letting winemakers irrigate their crops, something that's been banned in France, could make a difference. But even where traditional techniques and grapes are still being used, French wine is still changing with a changing climate. Nathalie Ola is head researcher at the experimental vineyard.
The wine is with a higher alcohol content and a lower acidity, and it affects the balance of the wine and also its ability to last and to be preserved.
For now, Ola says these changes are only doing good things to the taste of wine. She says this will change for the worse in about a generation. And if practices stay as they are, that will likely mean sour grapes. For The World, Rebecca Rossman, Bordeaux.
Find more of our Big Fix reporting at theworld.org/bigfix. Now, sour grapes are, of course, not the only risk posed by climate change. Another big one is financial instability. Get this, extreme weather events accounted for $2.2 trillion in losses in the 20-year period ending in 2017, according to the UN, and the trend has gotten dramatically worse. Christine Lagarde, president of the European Central Bank, spoke about this at an ECB forum this week.
If we are to completely ignore the consequences of climate change on the work that we do, on the assets that are held, and on the transition that we plan going forward, I think that's a risk to financial stability.
Moments later, chair of the U.S. Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, concurred. He said climate change is a top threat facing world economies.
Longer term, I would agree, both physical and transition risk from climate change for financial institutions.
All right, let's break that down. Physical risks mean damages from things like droughts, floods, and storms. Transition risks refer to how a shift to renewable energy may in turn hurt some sectors of the economy, like traditional energy companies that sell coal, oil, or natural gas. Chairman Powell's comments come just months before his term is set to expire. Some progressive groups are pushing for a replacement who focuses on regulating the climate risks that banks take on. That's what's happening in Europe. The European Central Bank plans to conduct its first climate stress test of banks next year, identifying the ones that are taking on more climate risk than they can afford. For example, it may not be financially sound to back a new high-rise tower in an area that could soon be underwater. And that is our show for this Thursday. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe. Stay strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
From PRX.